Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Green Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson, narrated by Richard Ferrone. This work is copyrighted 1994 by Kim Stanley Robinson. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books. Nearly a generation has passed since the first pioneers landed on Mars, surviving the airless cold to build the bare beginnings of a living colony. Now they have begun the amazing task of changing the red planet into an Earth-like paradise, a new garden for mankind. But all are not united in this endeavor. Among the dissenters are the first to be born and raised on this new world, and they are determined to preserve the hostile and barren beauty of the only home they've ever known. And now, Green Mars.
Part 1. Aerial Formation. The point is not to make another Earth. Not another Alaska or Tibet, not a Vermont nor a Venice, not even an Antarctica. The point is to make something new and strange, something Martian. In a sense, our intentions don't even matter. Even if we try to make another Siberia or Sahara, it won't work. Evolution won't allow it. And at its heart, this is an evolutionary process. An endeavor driven at a level below intention, as when life made its first miracle leap out of matter, or when it crawled out of sea onto land. Again, we struggle in the matrix of a new world, this time truly alien. Despite the great long glaciers left by the giant floods of 2061, it is a very arid world. Despite the beginnings of atmosphere creation, the air is still very thin. Despite all the applications of heat, the average temperature is still well below freezing. All these conditions make survival for living things difficult in the extreme. But life is tough and adaptable. It is the green force Viriditas pushing into the universe. In the decade following the catastrophes of 2061, people struggled in the cracked domes and torn tents, patching things up and getting by. And in our hidden refuges, the work of building a new society went on. And out on the cold surface, new plants spread over the flanks of the glaciers and down into the warm, low basins in a slow, inexorable surge. Of course, all the genetic templates for our new biota are Terran. The minds designing them are Terran. But the terrain is Martian. And terrain is a powerful genetic engineer, determining what flourishes and what doesn't, pushing along progressive differentiation, and thus the evolution of new species. And as the generations pass, all the members of a biosphere evolve together, adapting to their terrain in a complex communal response, a creative, self-designing ability. This process, no matter how much we intervene in it, is essentially out of our control. Genes mutate, creatures evolve. A new biosphere emerges, and with it a new noosphere. And eventually the designer's minds, along with everything else, have been forever changed. This is the process of aerioformation. One day the sky fell. Plates of ice crashed into the lake and then started thumping on the beach. The children scattered like frightened sandpipers. Nergal ran over the dunes to the village and burst into the greenhouse shouting, "The sky is falling! The sky is falling!" Peter sprinted out the doors and across the dunes faster than Nergal could follow. Back on the beach, great panes of ice stabbed the sand, and some chunks of dry ice fizzed in the water of the lake. When the children were all clumped around him, Peter stood with his head craned back, staring at the dome so far above. "Back to the village," he said in his no-nonsense tone. On the way there, he laughed. The sky is falling, he squeaked, tousling Nergal's hair. Nergal blushed, and Dao and Jackie laughed, their frosted breath shooting out in quick white plumes. Peter was one of those who climbed the side of the dome to repair it. He and Cassay and Michelle spidered over the village in sight of all, over the beach and then the lake, until they were smaller than children, hanging in slings from ropes attached to ice hooks. They sprayed the flaw in the dome with water until it froze into a new clear layer, coating the white dry ice. When they came down, they talked of the warming world outside. Hiroko had come out of her little bamboo stand by the lake to watch, and Nergal said to her, "Will we have to leave?" "We will always have to leave," Hiroko said. "Nothing on Mars will last." But Nergal liked it under the dome. In the morning he woke in his own round bamboo room, high in Kresh Crescent, and ran down to the frosty dunes with Jackie and Rachel and Franz and the other early risers. He saw Hiroko on the far shore walking the beach like a dancer, floating over her own wet reflection. He wanted to go to her, but it was time for school. They went back to the village and crowded into the schoolhouse coat room, hanging up their down jackets and standing with their blue hands stretched over the heating grate, waiting for the day's teacher. It could be Dr. Robot, and they would be bored senseless, counting his blinks like the seconds on the clock. It could be the good witch, old and ugly, and then they would be back outside building all day, exuberant with the joy of tools. Or it could be the bad witch, old and beautiful, and they would be stuck before their lecterns all morning trying to think in Russian, in danger of a rap on the hand if they giggled or fell asleep. The bad witch had silver hair and a fierce glare and a hooked nose, like the ospreys that lived in the pines by the lake. Nergal was afraid of her. So, like the others, he concealed his dismay as the school door opened and the bad witch walked in. But on this day she seemed tired and let them out on time, even though they had done poorly at arithmetic. Nergal followed Jackie and Dao out of the schoolhouse and around the corner, into the alley between Kresh Crescent and the back of the kitchen. Dao peed against the wall, and Jackie pulled down her pants to show she could, too, and just then the bad witch came around the corner. She pulled them all out of the alley by the arm, Nergal and Jackie clutched together in one of her talons, and right out in the plaza she spanked Jackie while shouting furiously at the boys. "You two stay away from her! She's your sister!" Jackie, crying and twisting to pull up her pants, saw Nergal looking at her, and she tried to hit him and Maya with the same furious swing, and fell over bare-bottomed and howled. It wasn't true that Jackie was their sister. There were 12 Sansei, or third-generation children, in Zygote, and they knew each other like brothers and sisters, and many of them were, but not all. It was confusing and seldom discussed. Jackie and Dao were the oldest, Nergal a season younger, the rest bunched a season after that. Rachel, Emily, Rule, Steve, Seemud, Nanadai, Tiu, Franz, and Huo Xing. Hiroko was mother to everyone in Zygote, but not really. Only to Nergal and Dao and 6 other of the Sansei, and several of the Nisei grown-ups as well. Children of the Mother Goddess. But Jackie was Esther's daughter. Esther had moved away after a fight with Kasei, who was Jackie's father. Not many of them knew who their fathers were. Once Nergal had been crawling over a dune after a crab when Esther and Kasei had loomed overhead, Esther crying and Kasei shouting, "If you're going to leave me, then leave!" He had been crying, too. He had a pink stone eye tooth. He, too, was a child of Hiroko's. So Jackie was Hiroko's granddaughter. That was how it worked. Jackie had long black hair and was the fastest runner in Zygote except for Peter. Nergal could run the longest and sometimes ran around the lake 3 or 4 times in a row just to do it, but Jackie was faster in the sprints. She laughed all the time. If Nergal ever argued with her, she would say, "All right, Uncle Nergi," and laugh at him. She was his niece, although a season older, but not his sister. The school door crashed open, and there was Coyote, teacher for the day. Coyote traveled all over the world and spent very little time in Zygote. It was a big day when he taught them. He led them around the village, finding odd things to do, but all the time he made one of them read aloud from books impossible to understand, written by philosophers who were dead people. Bakunin, Nietzsche, Mao, Bookchin. These people's comprehensible thoughts lay like unexpected pebbles on a long beach of gibberish. The stories Coyote had them read from the Odyssey or the Bible were easier to understand, though unsettling, as the people in them killed each other a lot, and Hiroko said it was wrong. Coyote laughed at Hiroko, and he often howled for no obvious reason as they read these gruesome tales and asked them hard questions about what they had heard and argued with them as if they knew what they were talking about, which was disconcerting. "What would you do? Why would you do that?" All the while teaching them how the Rickover's fuel recycler worked, or making them check the plunger hydraulics on the lake's wave machine until their hands went from blue to white and their teeth chattered so much they couldn't talk clearly. "You kids sure get cold easy," he said. "All but Nergal." Nergal was good with cold. He knew intimately all its many stages, and he didn't dislike the feel of it. People who disliked cold didn't understand that one could adjust to it, that its bad effects could all be dealt with by a sufficient push from within. Nergal was very familiar with heat as well. If you pushed heat out hard enough, then cold only became a sort of vivid, shocking envelope in which you moved, and so cold's ultimate effect was as a stimulant, making you want to run. "Hey, Nergal, what's the air temperature?" 271. Coyote's laugh was scary, an animal cackle that included all the noises anything could make. Different every time, too. "Here, let's stop the wave machine and see what the lake looks like flat." The water of the lake was always liquid, while the water ice coating the underside of the dome had to stay frozen. This explained most of their mesocosmic weather, as Sachs put it, giving them their mists and sudden winds, their rain and fog and occasional snow. On this day the weather machine was almost silent, the big hemisphere of space under the dome nearly windless. With the wave machine turned off, the lake soon settled down to a round, flat plate. The surface of the water became the same white color as the dome, but the lake bottom, covered by green algae, was still visible through the white sheen. So the lake was simultaneously pure white and dark green. On the far shore, the dunes and scrub pines were reflected upside down in this two-toned water as perfectly as in any mirror. Nergal stared at the sight, entranced, everything falling away, nothing there but this pulsing, green-white vision. He saw there were two worlds, not one. Two worlds in the same space, both visible, separate and different, but collapsed together, so that they were visible as two, only at certain angles. Push at vision's envelope. Push like one pushed against the envelope of cold. Push! Such colors. "Mars to Nergal! Mars to Nergal!" They laughed at him. He was always doing that, they told him. Going off. His friends were fond of him. He saw that in their faces. Coyote broke chips of flat ice from the strand, then skipped them across the lake. All of them did the same until the intersecting white-green ripples made the upside-down world shiver and dance. "Look at that!" Coyote shouted. Between throws, he chanted in his bouncing English that was like a perpetual song. "You kids are living the best lives in history. Most people are just fluid in the great world machine, and here you're in on the birth of a world. Unbelievable! But it's pure luck, you know. No credit to you, not until you do something with it. You could have been born in a mansion, a jail, a shanty town in Port of Spain. But here you are in Zygote, the secret heart of Mars. Course, just now you're down here like moles in a hole, with vultures above all ready to eat you. But the day is coming when you walk this planet free of every bond. You remember what I'm telling you. It's prophecy, my children. And meanwhile, look how fine it is, this little ice paradise." He threw a chip straight at the dome, and they all chanted, "Ice paradise, ice paradise, ice paradise," until they were helpless with laughter. But that night, Coyote spoke to Hiroko when he thought no one was listening. "Roko, you gotta take those kids outside and show them the world. Even if it's only under the fog hood. They're like moles in a hole down here, for Christ's sake." Then he was gone again, who knew where, off on one of his mysterious journeys into that other world folded over them. Some days Hiroko came into the village to teach them. These to Nergal were the best days of all. She always took them down to the beach, and going to the beach with Hiroko was like being touched by a god. It was her world, the green world inside the white, and she knew everything about it. And when she was there, the subtle pearly colors of sand and dome pulsed with both worlds' colors at once, pulsed as if trying to break free of what held them. They sat on the dunes, watching the shore birds skitter and peep as they charged together up and down the strand. Gulls wheeled overhead, and Hiroko asked them questions, her black eyes twinkling merrily. She lived by the lake with a small group of her intimates, Iwahu, Raya, Jean, Evgenia, all in a little bamboo stand in the dunes. And she spent a lot of time visiting other hidden sanctuaries around the South Pole. So she always needed catching up on the village news. She was a slender woman, tall for one of the Issei, as neat as the shorebirds in her dress and her movement. She was old, of course, impossibly ancient, like all the Issei, but with something in her manner which made her seem younger than even Peter or Kase, just a little bit older than the kids, in fact, with everything in the world new before her, pushing to break into all its colors. "Look at the pattern this seashell makes. The dappled whorl, curving inward to infinity. That's the shape of the universe itself. There's a constant pressure pushing toward pattern. A tendency in matter to evolve into ever more complex forms. It is a kind of pattern gravity. A holy greening power we call Veriditas, and it is the driving force in the cosmos. Life, you see. Like these sand fleas and limpets and krill, although these krill in particular are dead and helping the fleas. Like all of us," waving a hand like a dancer. "And because we are alive, the universe must be said to be alive. We are its consciousness as well as our own. We rise out of the cosmos, and we see its mesh of patterns, and it strikes us as beautiful. And that feeling is the most important thing in all the universe. Its culmination, like the color of the flower at first bloom on a wet morning. It's a holy feeling, and our task in this world is to do everything we can to foster it. And one way to do that is to spread life everywhere, to aid it into existence where it wasn't before, as here on Mars. This to her was the supreme act of love, and when she talked about it, even if they didn't fully understand, they felt the love. Another push, another kind of warmth in the envelope of cold. She touched them as she talked, and they dug for shells as they listened. Mud clam, Antarctic limpet, glass sponge, watch out, it can cut you. It made Nergal happy just to look at her. And one morning, as they stood from their dig to do more beachcombing, she returned his gaze, and he recognized her expression. It was precisely the expression on his face when he looked at her. He could feel it in his muscles. So he made her happy, too, which was intoxicating. He held her hand as they walked the beach. It's a simple ecology, in some ways, she said as they knelt to inspect another clamshell. Not many species, and the food chains are short, but so rich, so beautiful. She tested the temperature of the lake with her hand. See the mist? The water must be warm today. By this time, she and Nergal were alone, the other kids running around the dunes or up and down the strand. Nergal bent down to touch a wave as it stalled out next to their feet, leaving behind a white lace of foam. It's 275 and a little over. You're so sure. I can always tell. Here, she said. Do I have a fever? He reached up and held her neck. No, you're cool. That's right. I'm always about half a degree low. Vlad and Ursula can't figure out why. It's because you're happy. Hiroko laughed, looking just like Jackie, suffused with joy. I love you, Nergal. Inside he warmed as if a heating grate were in there, half a degree at least. And I love you. And they walked down the beach hand in hand, silently following the sandpipers. Coyote returned, and Hiroko said to him, Okay, let's take them outside. And so the next morning, when they met for school, Hiroko and Coyote and Peter led them through the locks and down the long white tunnel that connected the dome to the outside world. At its far end were located the hangar and the cliff gallery above it. They had run the gallery with Peter in the past, looking out the little polarized windows at the icy sand and the pink sky, trying to see the great wall of dry ice that they stood in, the South Polar Cap, the bottom of the world which they lived in to escape the notice of people who had put them in jail. Because of that, they had always stayed inside the gallery. But on this day, they went into the hangar locks and put on tight elastic jumpers, rolling up sleeves and legs, then heavy boots and tight gloves, and last, helmets with bubble windows on their front side, getting more excited every moment until the excitement became something very like fright, especially when Seemud started crying and insisting she didn't want to go. Hiroko calmed her with a long touch. Come on. I'll be there with you. They huddled together speechlessly as the adults herded them into the lock. There was a hissing noise, and then the outer door opened. Clutching the adults, they walked cautiously outside, bumping together as they moved. It was too bright to see. They were in a swirling white mist. The ground was dotted with intricate ice flowers, all aglint in the bath of light. Nergal was holding Hiroko and Coyote by the hand, and they propelled him forward and let go of his hands. He staggered in the onslaught of white glare. This is the fog hood, Hiroko's voice said over an intercom in his ear. It lasts through the winter. But now it's LS-205, springtime, when the green force pushes hardest through the world, fueled by the sun's light. See it. He could see nothing but it. A white coalescing fireball. Sudden sunlight pierced this ball, transforming it into a spray of color, turning the frosty sand to shaved magnesium, the ice flowers to incandescent jewels. The wind pushed at his side and rent the fog. Gaps in it appeared, and the land gaped off into the distance, making him reel. So big! So big! Everything was so big! He went to one knee on the sand, put his hands on his other leg to keep his balance. The rocks and ice flowers around his boots glowed as if under a microscope. The rocks were dotted with round scales of black and green lichen. Out on the horizon was a low, flat-topped hill, a crater. There in the gravel was a rover track, nearly filled with frost, as if it had been there a million years, pattern pulsing in the chaos of light and rock, green lichen pushing into the white. Everyone was talking at once. The other children were beginning to race around giddily, shrieking with delight as the fog opened up and gave them a glimpse of the dark pink sky. Coyote was laughing hard. "They're like winter calves let out of the barn in spring. Look at them tripping. Oh, you poor dear things. Groco, this no way to make them live." Cackling as he lifted kids off the sand and set them on their feet again. Nergal stood, bounced experimentally. He felt he might float away. He was glad the boots were so heavy. There was a long mound, shoulder high, snaking away from the ice cliff. Jackie was walking its crest and he ran to join her, staggering at the incline, at the jumbled rock on the ground. He got onto the ridge and got into his running rhythm, and it felt as if he were flying, as if he could run forever. He stood by her side. They looked back at the ice cliff and shouted with a fearful joy. It rose up forever into the fog. A shaft of morning light poured over them like molten water. They turned away, unable to face it. Blinking away floods of tears, Nergal saw his shadow cast against the fog scraping over the rocks below them. The shadow was surrounded by a bright circular band of rainbow light. He shouted loudly, and Coyote raced up to them, his voice in Nergal's ear crying, "What's wrong? What is it?" He stopped when he saw the shadow. "Hey, it's a glory! That's called a glory! It's like the specter of the Brocken! Wave your arms up and down. Look at the colors! Christ almighty, aren't you the lucky ones?" On an impulse, Nergal moved to Jackie's side, and their glories merged, becoming a single nimbus of glowing rainbow colors surrounding their blue double shadow. Jackie laughed with delight and went off to try it with Peter. About a year later, Nergal and the other children began to figure out how to deal with the days when they were taught by Sax. He would start at the blackboard sounding like a particularly characterless AI, and behind his back they would roll their eyes and make faces as he droned on about partial pressures or infrared rays. Then one of them would see an opening and begin the game. He was helpless before it. He would say something like, "In non-shivering thermogenesis, the body produces heat using futile cycles." And one of them would raise a hand and say, "But why, Sax?" And everyone would stare hard at their lectern and not look at each other, while Sax would frown as if this had never happened before and say, "Well, it creates heat without using as much energy as shivering does. The muscle proteins contract, but instead of grabbing, they just slide over each other, and that creates the heat." Jackie, so sincerely the whole class nearly lost it. "But how?" He was blinking now, so fast they almost exploded watching him. "Well, the amino acids in the proteins have broken covalent bonds, and the breaks release what is called bond dissociation energy."
But why?
Blinking ever harder. Well, that's just a matter of physics. He diagrammed vigorously on the blackboard. Covalent bonds are formed when two atomic orbitals merge to form a single bond orbital occupied by electrons from both atoms. Breaking the bond releases 30 to 100 kcals of stored energy. Several of them asked in chorus, "But why?" This got him into subatomic physics, where the chain of whys and becauses could go on for a half hour without him ever once saying something they could understand. Finally, they would sense they were near the end game.
"But why?"
"Well," going cross-eyed as he tried to backtrack, "atoms want to get to their stable number of electrons, and they'll share electrons when they have to."
"But why?"
Now he was looking trapped. "That's just the way atoms bond. One of the ways."
"But why?"
A shrug. "That's how the atomic force works. That's how things came out." And they all would shout, "In the Big Bang!" They would howl with glee, and Sax's forehead would nod up as he realized that they had done it to him again. He would sigh and go back to where he had been when the game began. But every time they started it again, he never seemed to remember as long as the initial why was plausible enough. And even when he did recognize what was happening, he seemed helpless to stop it. His only defense was to say, with a little frown, "Why, what?" That slowed the game for a while. But then Nergal and Jackie got clever at guessing what in any statement most deserved a why, and as long as they could do that, Sax seemed to feel it was his job to continue answering right on up the chains of because to the Big Bang, or every once in a while to a muttered, "We don't know." "We don't know," the class would exclaim in mock dismay. "Why not?" "It's not explained," he would say, frowning. "Not yet." And so the good mornings with Sax would pass, and both he and the kids seemed to agree that these were better than the bad mornings when he would drone on uninterrupted and protest, "This is really a very important matter," as he turned from the blackboard and saw a crop of heads laid out snoring on the desktops. One morning, thinking about Sax's frown, Nergal stayed behind in the school until he and Sax were the only ones left, and then he said, "Why don't you like it when you can't say why?" The frown returned. After a long silence, Sax said slowly, "I try to understand. I pay attention to things, you see, very closely. As closely as I can, concentrating on the specificity of every moment. And I want to understand why it happens the way it does. I'm curious, and I think that everything happens for a reason. Everything. So we should be able to tease these reasons out. When we can't, well, I don't like it. It vexes me. Sometimes I call it..." He glanced at Nergal shyly, and Nergal saw that he had never told this to anyone before. "I call it the great unexplainable." It was the white world, Nergal saw suddenly. The white world inside the green, the opposite of Hiroko's green world inside the white. And they had opposite feelings about them. Looking from the green side, when Hiroko confronted something mysterious, she loved it, and it made her happy. It was Veriditas, a holy power. Looking from the white side, when Sax confronted something mysterious, it was the great unexplainable, dangerous and awful. He was interested in the true, while Hiroko was interested in the real. Or perhaps it was the other way around. Those words were tricky. Better to say she loved the green world, he the white. But yes, Michelle said when Nergal mentioned this observation to him. Very good, Nergal. Your sight has such insight. In archetypal terminologies, we might call green and white the mystic and the scientist. Both extremely powerful figures, as you see. But what we need, if you ask me, is a combination of the two, which we call the alchemist. The green and the white. Afternoons, the children were free to do what they wanted, and sometimes they stayed with the day's teacher, but more often they ran on the beach or played in the village, which lay nestled in its cluster of low hills, halfway between the lake and the tunnel entrance. They climbed the spiraling staircases of the big bamboo tree houses and played hide-and-seek among the stacked rooms and the daughter chutes and the hanging bridges connecting them. The bamboo dorms made a crescent which held most of the rest of the village inside it. Each of the big chutes was 5 or 7 segments high, each segment a room, getting smaller as they got higher. The children each had a room of their own in the top segments of the chutes, windowed vertical cylinders that were 4 or 5 steps across, like the towers of the castles in their stories. Below them, in the middle segments, the adults had their rooms, mostly alone but sometimes in couples, and the bottom segments were living rooms. From the windows of their top rooms, they looked down on the village rooftops, clustered in the circle of hills and bamboo and greenhouses like mussels in the lake shallows. On the beach they hunted shells or played German dodgeball or shot arrows across the dunes into blocks of foam. Usually Jackie and Dow chose the games and led the teams if there were teams. Nergal and the younger ones followed them, cycling through their various friendships and hierarchies which were honed endlessly in the daily play. As little Franz once crudely explained it to Nadia, Dow hits Nergal, Nergal hits me, I hit the girls. Often Nergal got tired of that game, which Dao always won, and for better fun he would take off running around the lake slowly and steadily, falling into a rhythm which seemed to encompass everything in the world. He could circle the lake for as long as the day lasted when he got in that rhythm. It was a joy, an exhilaration, just to run and run and run and run. Under the dome it was always cold, but the light was perpetually changing. In summer the dome glowed bluish-white all the time, and pencils of lit air stood under the skylight shafts. In winter it was dark, and the dome flared with reflected lamplight like the inside of a mussel shell. In spring and fall the light would dim in the afternoon to a gray and ghostly dusk, the colors only suggested by the many shades of gray, the bamboo leaves and pine needles all ink strokes against the faint white of the dome. In those hours the greenhouses were like big fairy lamps on the hills, and the kids would wander home crisscrossing like gulls and head for the bathhouse. There in the long building beside the kitchen they would pull off their clothes and run into the steamy clangor of the big main bath, sliding around on the bottom tiles, feeling heat buzz back into their hands and feet and faces as they splashed friskily around the soaking ancients with their turtle faces and their wrinkled hairy bodies. After that warm, wet hour they dressed and trooped into the kitchen, damp and pink-skinned, queuing up and filling their plates, sitting at the long tables scattered among the adults. There were 124 permanent residents, but usually about 200 people there at any given time. When everyone was seated, they took up the water pitchers and poured each other's water, and then they tore into the hot food with gusto, downing potatoes, tortillas, pasta, tabbouleh, bread, 100 kinds of vegetables, occasionally fish or chicken. After the meal, the adults would talk about crops or their rickover, an old integral fast reactor they were very fond of, or about Earth, while the kids cleaned up and then played music for an hour and then games, as everyone began the slow process of falling asleep. One day before dinner, a group of 22 people arrived from around the polar cap. Their little dome had lost its ecosystem to what Oroko called spiraling complex disequilibrium, and their reserves had run out. They needed sanctuary. Hiroko put them in three of the newly mature tree houses. They climbed the staircases spiraling up the outsides of the fat round chutes, exclaiming at the cylindrical segments with their doors and windows cut into them. Hiroko put them to work finishing construction on new rooms and building a new greenhouse at the edge of the village. It was obvious to all that Zygote was not growing as much food as they now needed. The kids ate as modestly as they could, imitating the adults.
"Should have called the place Gamete," Coyote said to Hiroko on his next time through, laughing harshly.
She only waved him away, but perhaps worry accounted for Hiroko's more distant air. She spent all her days in the greenhouses at work and seldom taught the children anymore. When she did, they only followed her around and worked for her, harvesting or turning compost or weeding.
"She doesn't care about us,"
Dao said angrily one afternoon as they walked down the beach. He directed his complaint at Nergal.
"She isn't really our mother anyway."
He led them all to the labs by the Tunnel Hill greenhouse, chivying them along as he could so well. Inside, he pointed to a row of fat magnesium tanks, something like refrigerators.
"Those are our mothers. That's what we were grown inside. Kasei told me, and I asked Hiroko, and it's true. We're ectogenes. We weren't born, we were decanted."
He glared triumphantly at his frightened, fascinated little band. Then he struck Nergal full on the chest with his fist, knocking Nergal clear across the lab, and left with a curse.
"We don't have parents!"
This ends side one of cassette one. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.